This is Leland Sklar from the immediate family, and you are listening to the Rock Solid Podcast.
Make me a deal and make it good for me. I won't get full of myself, I can't afford to be. This is small town music, this is big town music. He's ahead of his time, you know, but he can't use it. If only he could prove it. Well, tomorrow's just a song away, a song away, a song away.
Hey everybody, welcome to Rock Solid, the comedy podcast for all things music, both new and classic. I'm Pat Francis, and joining me in the Zoom room to promote the release of Skin in the Game, the new album by his band, The Immediate Family, please welcome bassist Leland Sklar. Hello, Leland.
Hi, Pat. It's nice to be here.
Nice to see you. Did we vote this week?
Yeah, absolutely.
Me too.
Absolutely. I mean, that's one of the great honors and things that we should all appreciate being in this country. And it's remarkable how few people do it. You know, they can go to Starbucks. They have time to do that, but they can't go to a polling place.
I was shocked yesterday when I was talking to some people and they didn't vote. And they just said, oh, it doesn't really matter. And I'm just like, wow, people.
Yeah, it's sad. It's really tragic.
It is tragic.
When things don't go their way and they're suddenly getting screwed, they kind of go, oh, you know, it shouldn't be this way. Well, it shouldn't, but if you had gotten off your butt and done something, you might have had a shot at it. But you can't bitch about it if you're complacent.
That's right. If you can't complain if you don't vote. Leland, I'm a fan of your YouTube channel. I've watched it for years, and I would be remiss if I didn't ask, because I'm not caught up on all the videos. There's over 1,600 videos there. How is your wife Maureen feeling right now?
She's getting better by the day. We were, for those that don't know, we were on vacation. When I finished touring last year, we went to Spain on a vacation and we rented a house with six other dear friends outside of Barcelona. And there was a big tree in the yard. It had a swing on it. And she was swinging and the swing broke and dropped her on her back on concrete and shattered her. It burst her T12 vertebrae. And when you do anything in Spain, you're in deep trouble. They give no pain medication, misdiagnosed it. I had to get her home, and the doctors here at Keck at USC said she could have been paralyzed or killed by what happened. So she's gone from a gurney to a wheelchair to a walker to a cane. She's still in discomfort, but it's a slow process. The hard part now is she's antsy to get her life back. And if sure. She pushes it too hard, she feels it. So pacing her is the hard part.
All right.
We're getting a new puppy. So she's going to have her work cut out for her in puppydom.
All right. Well, I'm glad to hear that she's on the mend. When I watched the video of that story, it was one of those freak things. I'm like, oh my God, this could happen to anyone. Of course, you're on vacation and you see a swing in a tree and you're like, oh my God, look at that. Let's get on that. I mean, it wasn't anything. She wasn't skydiving. It's just a freak thing.
And you just don't know. I mean, I've had friends that were out bicycling, you know, just and something happened. They hit something and they fell off their bike and hit the curb and died. You know, hit their head on the curb. I mean, you just have to appreciate every moment you got because you never know.
I mean, Warren Zevon's famous quote is "Enjoy every sandwich."
It's so true.
It's really true.
Yeah, true.
So what I'm going to do right now is I'm going to thoroughly enjoy my conversation with you, Leland.
Me too.
Okay, so my wife and I saw your show at the Mint last month with Elliot Easton filling in for Waddy.
Yeah.
It was an amazing show. As we're walking in, as we're driving there from Woodland Hills, I said to my wife, I go, I think we're going to see Jackson Browne here tonight. And sure enough, we were there for about 15 minutes and right through the front door walks Jackson Browne. And I got such a thrill from that because I'm such a big fan.
Me too.
And then I saw you made a video about Wendy Malick. And that I love that because I kept looking at this woman and I'm like, I think that's Wendy Malick. Now, I know how old Wendy Malick is And I kept looking at this woman. I'm like, that can't be her. She looks fantastic, like ageless. But now you've proven to me that that was indeed Wendy Malick.
Yeah, she is so delightful. There's a documentary movie about the immediate family, our band. And Denny Tedesco, who directed it, and I went to St. Augustine, Florida for a film festival down there. And there was a movie that Wendy is in, and she was there promoting that. So we got a chance to hang out there because Wendy and I met when James Taylor married his second wife, Catherine Walker.
Yes.
They decided they wanted to have everybody dance at the wedding. So they sent everybody to a dance class to learn how to like waltz, which didn't work out very well. But Wendy was at the wedding too. So that's the first time we spent any time together was at dance class.
Okay.
And then I did, did some music with Wendy. So it was really fun having it there. And there are people like that. We did, not that long ago, did an album with Susanna Hoffs. From the Bangles.
Are a stain on my notebook that rings your goodbye. Now he's gone, and I'm back on the beat. A stain on my notebook says.
You look, you're around her. She looks and acts like she's in her 30s. And I think she's 65 now.
Yeah. She just turned 65. She's ageless also.
You kind of go, how did this happen? Cause she really acts. She's her body, her demeanor, everything is like a kid.
Yeah. And
it's really amazing. So Wendy's like that too.
It comes from within. I believe it comes from within. It was great that you guys integrated three Cars songs into the set list. I'm sure that made Elliot feel great knowing that he just wasn't a hired hand for some shows.
Well, we find ourselves in a difficult situation being who we are because we want to promote the band. We want to do things, but we all have obligations that have been long term. And with Waddy Wachtel, he's been Stevie Nicks' musical director since Buckingham Nicks days in the very beginning. And she really can't go on the road without Waddy at her side. That's he's her security blanket.
Yeah.
And we had a period of time that they said, we're not going to be working. And so that's when we got all these gigs booked. And then they decided they were going to work. They were making up gigs they lost during COVID. And we're suddenly sitting here going, what the hell are we going to do? And I've worked with Elliot over the years and everybody knew him as a friend, and we went, well, he's got creds because he's in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. The Cars were great. They had great songs. He's a great musician and a dear friend. So we called him and he said, I'd love to do it. So it worked. It's perfect because it's given us a window for the rest of the year.
Yeah.
Because Stevie keeps adding gigs. So I'm kind of looking at Waddy as going to be gone most of the year.
Yeah.
Which I'm grateful for him because he loves the gig and it's his bread and butter. But Elliot said, I'd love to do it. So we have Elliot with us until such time as Waddy comes, you know, back, and then we'll see, maybe we'll add another guy to the band.
Who knows? You never know, but
who cares? We're having fun. That's all I care about.
Look, at this point in your career, having fun is good stuff.
Yeah. It's wonderful.
I also want to mention your book, Everybody Loves Me. It's a big coffee table book. I have a copy of it. There you go. Tell people about that book. What am I going to find inside that book?
You're going to have a lot of people considering you number one by expressing a hand gesture to make you look like you're number one.
There you go.
This was a weird thing. Real briefly, and you can edit it out if you need to.
I would not ever edit anything out.
When we were on the road with Phil Collins in 2004, there was talk at the end of that tour that Phil was thinking about retiring at that point. Mm-hmm. And I had a, they hired a bass tech for me on the tour. And he had come, I think, off of a tour where the bass player had like 10 basses and wanted new strings every day and all this stuff. So he was so prepared. And he, so when I met him, he says, so what do you need? And I said, well, nothing. I just have one bass and I kind of do it all myself. So we were out for like a year. And so during the whole year, he ended up becoming like a gopher for all of the, you know, the singers, getting them lozenges and stuff. So this incredibly overqualified guy. So every day we'd look at each other and just kind of go, I mean, we were really good friends. But at the end of the tour, when I heard about Phil, I thought, I'm going to take pictures of everybody, because we had about 100 crew people out there.
Wow. Yeah.
And I thought, I may never see any of these people again if Phil retires, because they're from all over the world. And that, what brings us together is Phil. So the first person I go up to is Chinner, the bass tech, and he's sitting at his laptop working. And I said, hey, Chinner, give me a smile. And all he does is goes. And I took the picture and I looked at him. This is actually pretty good. So I went and got Phil, Tony Smith, his manager, the caterers, the truck drivers, the pilots for the planes, the band, the crew, everybody. I had about 150 pictures. And I put it away, you know, just my little folder for future reference. And then like 3 years later, I went out, I did the first time I went on the road with Toto, and I did the same thing, got all the guys and all the crew on that. And then it took on a life of its own. And at this point, this book has about 6,000 pictures in it of people flipping me off, but I have probably over 13,000 pictures.
Oh my God.
So, I mean, there's, let's see if I can find anything in here to show you real quick. That's. Well, I you know, I end up looking at pictures, you know, where I've got, you know, there's David Crosby and Henry Diltz in there.
Yeah, amazing.
Yeah, I mean, it's, there's so much, and there's so many in here that when I really look through it, I mean, there's Lyle Lovett after his colonoscopy.
Oh my goodness.
Billy Bob Thornton.
Now, what, can I ask, why are you with Lyle Lovett at his colonoscopy?
It's one of the few pictures I didn't take. His wife.
Okay.
Took
okay.
But I thought I have to have Lyle's picture from his colonoscopy. But you know, I've got Jeff Beck and Charlie Watts and
amazing.
So but all of this kind of came about because of COVID.
Mm-hmm.
COVID really, like everybody else, all of a sudden my date book went, you know, everything blew away and it was all empty. And you're starting to think, now what do I do? And so a lot of things opened up, like doing the YouTube channel, doing the book, starting to record from home and, you know, things like that. So I tried to look at it as horrid as a period as it was, because I had friends die during that. And I have other friends that are long COVID and
yeah,
I've had it and everybody I know's had. I looked at it as an opportunity to try to rediscover myself and figure out things to do rather than sitting around going, woe is me.
Yeah. You have to pivot and find, you know, as hard as it is, or as hard as it sounds, find a positive among this negative thing that happened. So the documentary, The Immediate Family, directed by Denny Tedesco, streaming everywhere right now. I've watched it 3 times. When Denny's documentary for The Wrecking Crew came out, I didn't really know about The Wrecking Crew. So that was a learning experience for me. Yeah. But when this came out, I was like, oh, these are my guys. These are the guys that I would see on every album I would purchase, you know, in my teen years. So this was just fantastic. I actually think it's, well, for me, it's better than The Wrecking Crew doc. It's just perfect. I love everything about it. All the stories. You guys are so funny together. You have such a nice chemistry. You can bust each other's balls and then laugh about it.
Yeah.
It really is a family. It's really an immediate family.
Yeah. Well, and for Denny too, he said, you know, when he made this, he said, this was the music of my generation. He knew us better than he knew the Wrecking Crew people, because that was a previous generation.
That was his dad's generation.
His dad's generation. And it is such, The Wrecking Crew was such a brilliant film.
Mm-hmm.
And I was very fortunate that when I started working, I got to work with those people. I was one of the transitional musicians. So I worked with Hal Blaine and Tommy Tedesco and Larry Nechtel and all those people every day. And they were like mentors for me when I was getting started. And when I saw that movie, I was so moved by it. And I would go, and I was a part of the Q&As, being one of these transitional guys. So it was really fun to be involved with them. And so when it was pitched to us that Denny was going to do this thing, I said, I'm totally there, because I knew from whence he came, you know, yeah, work-wise, and I knew it was going to be, you know, great. It's just still hard to kind of come to grips to think of yourself as the subject of a movie.
Yeah.
Because you're just happy to go to work every day and do what we do. So to suddenly see your life laid out in this way in your career, we all kind of still look at each other kind of, ooh, this is pretty weird, you know, but... But the response has been so wonderful to it. I mean, it's won so many festivals and still, you know, going strong. And they just released it on Blu-ray, where there's 3 extra hours.
Oh, I got to get that then, because when it was over, I wanted more.
Yeah, I've got it. I just got it yesterday. I think this is the immediate family on Blu-ray.
Oh, amazing. Okay, I'm going to contact Denny today and get him to send some over.
Yeah, no, it's great. It's really great. It's really great.
Leland, you strike me as a very humble person, like that you don't enjoy a compliment, or you don't take a compliment easily. Am I correct in thinking that?
Hate it. I don't know. I've been that way since I was a little kid. Mm-hmm. You know, people start to compliment me on something, I usually try to throw up a diversionary tactic. Like if we're doing a gig and people come up and go, oh, you were great. I go, yeah, but man, did you check out so-and-so tonight? It's like the best. I always try to buffer that, because, yeah, I have my own levels of confidence in what I do, and I have my own levels of insecurity in what I do. And so when there's attention drawn, it's not something that I enjoy the interaction with people. I just don't enjoy the adulation that can come with it.
Sadly, the interaction with you is probably always complimentary.
Yeah, it's a balancing act all the time with it. But you know, I've learned to deal with it. It's just my own personal neuroses that, you know, that rears its head like a festering pimple at times.
Well, then I promise that for the rest of the convo, I will not say that you're one of my favorite bass players. I will not say that you're iconic, and I will not say that you're a legendary musician. I won't say any of those things.
Okay, good. I'm glad I didn't hear that.
Yeah, we'll just get through it. Let's talk a little bit about Skin in the Game, the new full-length LP from the immediate family. Every time I have someone on and they have a new album out, I feel like I'm always saying, I think this is better than the last one. But so I don't want my listeners to think I'm disingenuous, but this is better than the last LP. This, you guys are really coming into it now, songwriting together, the production, the playing, the singing, everything is better than the last time. I mean, I just feel it is.
I agree with you. It's one of these things that, one of the things I appreciate about the band so much is pretty much, other than our Steve Postel in the band, the rest of us have been together going on 54 years.
Yeah.
There's an interaction and a relationship that's been evolutionary through this whole time. And the more time we get together, something new happens each time. And the thing that was great that I enjoy about this is there's other bands that have come out of, like, the, say they were 70s or 80s bands. When they kind of reform and get back together, they're sort of living on what they did back then. The thing I love about this is everybody's hungry to keep growing. So it's all fresh writing, it's all fresh playing. And I think that's the thing that's making it feel so good and why there's been some interest in it. It's not a nostalgia group that, you know, we all joked and said it would have been great if we could have been nominated for Best New Artist.
You know? Right. But that would have been great.
Yeah, but the immediate family isn't a recognized name. I mean, we're trying to build a brand, you know, but people actually investigate and they suddenly see the names of the guys in the band. They go, oh, holy crap, they're on all my records, kind of a thing. It's an interesting dilemma that we have building, really like we're a teenage band trying to build a fan base. Now, the good thing is we can get out there and play, and we have people helping with the promotion and like with the documentary. The thing that Denny said was so amazing to him when he, you know, started to do it was every artist that they contacted to see if they would be interested said, absolutely, let's do it now. And they called Carole King and they were recording her 3 weeks after contacting her. So we have this whole relationship in this industry that's really, really powerful. And now it's just a matter of hipping the public to it. And it's building. It's a slow process. But the fact that we still get to do what we love to do, you can't beat that. It may never be, you know, the top of the charts or anything like that, but the people who are into it, the gigs we've been playing, we're filling the places we're playing, you know, like the Libero in Santa Barbara. And we've done, you know, starting to get into that level rather than just in the Mint.
Yeah.
So it's getting there. And we had a great time. We just came off of the Rock Legends cruise and it was like Bret Michaels and Sammy Hagar and Billy Gibbons. And people were coming up to me going, God, you're our favorite band on there. Where everybody's great, but they're discovering it. They knew what they were doing with the other people, but with us, they're suddenly hearing songs of their youth, and they're going, oh, this is unbelievable. So it's great. I'm having a ball with them.
And look, a lot of people might not know your individual names.
Yeah.
But then when they discover it through this film and through shows, they're just like blown away. They're just like, whoa, wait a minute. What? These guys played on what and when and with who? I mean, there's not enough hours in the day to talk about everyone you've worked with. It's just so diverse.
Well, it's a unique journey that we're on. I can't think of another band that's ever gone through what we're going through with what our history is and how we all interact with each other and how we interact with this vast array of artists and how it's come to this. And so I'm trying to just enjoy every moment of it. But I'm also grateful that I'm still working every day on other projects and that, you know, my career, as far as my gut tells me, is far from over because my hands are still working. So I can still play. And I go on the road now. I mean, I'm back on tour tomorrow with Lyle Lovett. Yet I've got two album projects to do in the hotel rooms. I carry stuff with me to work it. So it's all good.
Retirement is only for people who don't like what they do.
Absolutely. Yeah. I it was interesting when I was out with Toto a couple of years back, we were checking into a hotel in Grand Rapids, Michigan. And as we're checking in, we hear a banging on the window and we look out and Abe Laboreal Jr. is out there pounding on the window, who plays drums with McCartney. And I've known Abe since he was a little kid. His dad's one of my favorite bass players. And he comes in and he said, so what are you guys doing? We said, we're playing down the street tomorrow night. He goes, well, we're playing there with Paul tonight. Come to the show. So we went there early and we're sitting around the dressing room with Abe and everybody and with Paul. And I'm sitting there talking to him, and I was, you know, I've met Paul a few times in the past, and yeah, I was reminding him that I was an usher at the Hollywood Bowl when the Beatles played there. But we were talking, and you know, and at that point, I think Paul was probably 72, and he's going, "What else am I going to do?" You know, I mean, this is his DNA. This is his entire life, and why would, when people say, "So when are you going to hang it up?" And I guess you only hang it up when you can't do it anymore.
Yeah, when you actually can't do it. Yeah, when Paul releases new music, I have friends that say, why is he releasing new music? I'm like, because he can't not release new music.
Yeah.
Because he can't stop the creativity from coming in. And what's he just going to keep it for himself? No, give it to us.
No, I love it. I love he's still out there doing 3-hour shows and killing it. You know, he may not be singing like he did when he was 20 years old. But who is, you know, I mean,
yeah, very few people can keep up vocally like that. It's hard.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, with Phil Collins, we ended up, you know, lowering some of the songs keys and stuff, but he looked at it like he goes, you know, I always forget that when I'm in the studio cutting this song, that's all I'm doing that day.
Yeah.
You know, so it's easy in that key, but suddenly you're out on the road. And with Phil, we average 3 to 3.5 hour shows. And you, suddenly you put that song in a 3 hour show and you're working a lot of shows. You suddenly go, this is killing me. And so you lower the key, you know, a half step or a whole step. It's not the end of the world, but people right. start, oh, they're getting so old, they can't do it anymore. Sometimes it's just when you cut it, you were fresh and suddenly you're trying to sing it again after 2.5 hours of belting it out. It's a different thing, but.
Yeah, it's necessary sometimes. So
yeah, you have to for the sake of the show.
Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, what's your secret? Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Let's talk about Skin in the Game. Are all the songs written by committee now, or are people bringing in songs and then everyone works on it? How's it work?
Well, mostly, I would say it's a little of everything. A lot of it is like Waddy will come up with something at home. He's got a home studio and he'll come in with a good sketch of something and then everybody starts to contribute to that. There's other times when we're all together and we're kind of jamming and throwing ideas around. So it really can be kind of anything. The thing that's interesting to me is the dominant writers are Waddy and Cooch and Steve.
Okay.
And each of them has a really unique approach to it. Waddy's really more rock and roll than anybody. Cooch can be more R&B funky oriented, and Steve is more kind of folk idiom driven. And Russ and I just kind of dig what they're doing and then find our parts to that. And sometimes one of them will bring something in and everybody else will go, why don't we try this? So the core of what they came with is there, but by the time it's done, the band signature is more prevalent on it. But everybody's, you know, has their own way of approaching it. And the nice thing is we recorded like 6 or 8 other songs that didn't make it on the record. Not that they weren't good songs, but at a certain point, just like the documentary, you have to stop at some point.
Right.
And so now we've got material that if we wanted to go out and do some gigs and we were doing multiple nights, we might throw some tunes in that aren't on the album. Just to keep people fresh with it. And then maybe those will rear their head when the next project comes along.
All right. Let me ask you about track 3, Toughest Girl in Town. Who is the toughest girl in town? Is that someone specific?
Well, the thing with that is that's the only cover on the album. That's a Sparks tune.
It is
Sparks.
Well, yeah. I don't have the liner notes in front of me. Now I feel like I haven't done good research. But no.
Yeah, that was a Sparks tune that Waddy. We all like Sparks, but he was going through like a Sparks thing, and he heard that song and he immediately came to us and said, "We got to do this song." And so that's the one cover on this album that we did. That's not an original.
All right. But, well, I love it.
I love the song.
Now I got to go hear the Sparks original and compare it with what you guys did. And all right. Hey, look, I don't know everything. I only know what I think I know, folks. Catch You on the Other Side, another one of my favorites.
Lots of things I've done I should have never. I confused tomorrow with forever. Raised my fist in anger, then I opened my hand. I didn't want to hurt nobody. I tried to understand. I've been smashed and broken. I laughed till I cried. I'll catch you on the other side. I believed in love, it broke me down. I believed in heroes, but they're better in the ground. I planted in the...
Who brought this one in?
You know, I don't remember at this point. I mean, the thing is, we cut most of this stuff quite some time ago.
Uh-huh.
And because of COVID, everything kind of, we didn't release it for a long time because we thought we can't go promote it. We can't do anything with this
right.
stuff. And it would have just been throwing the album away to release it and just have it go out and die. And then, and plus the documentary was still being worked on. And we thought, let's just try to release both of them in approximately the same time so we can cross collateralize.
Makes sense.
Promotion and all that. So at this point, the actual process, the only thing I truly remember about making the record was how quickly we make records. I mean, pretty much we had everything all finished up in about a week.
Wow.
I mean, most everything is like first or second takes. Once we figure the song out, we go for absolute the freshest you can be. We don't flog the stuff. And we were very fortunate that, like you said, you know, you saw Jackson at the Mint. Jackson's been a supporter of the band yeah. since day one. And he let us use his studio down in Santa Monica to record in. Nice. And he would come and hang out at the sessions and stuff with us. But we pretty much got in there and nailed everything basic track wise. And then Waddy and Steve both have home studios. So then they could take things home and work on the vocals if we needed to do any extra vocal stuff, or maybe, you know, another guitar solo or yeah. some percussion thing. But for the most part, the process for us, it's really hard to drag it out because we've gotten so used to over the years of immediately jumping into a song and finding our parts and cutting it when it's as fresh as it can be. And so for me, you know, when I'm going back and thinking about the album now, it's like it's a distant memory because it was we've done so much since we cut the album I'd really have to sit and give it some ponderous thoughts at this point.
Well, it's a great album, 14 tracks. I love the sequencing. You guys, you know, you hit a home run, and I hope more people seek it out and find it and get into some of the new music you guys are making.
I hope so, too. And I'm also really happy that we pressed vinyl on this because we are all, as much as, you know, one of my things is I never want to become an old fart, no matter what I look like here. I don't want to be an old fart. I want to feel engaged and fresh every day and no matter what's going on. But having vinyl, it harkens back to sequencing
yeah.
an album.
Two sides.
The two sides, the space between tracks that was always to me is so important because we used to always go like to the mastering room and when things were being done and we'd sit there and we'd all be sitting there and the first track would end and we'd that's where the second, you know, sometimes you want space. Sometimes you want them to butt up close.
Right.
And you, how do you end side A and how do you start side B?
Yep.
So to have an actual album, we were able to really do that rather than just releasing it as a, you know, a CD or just, you know, putting it on streaming platforms where people might only listen to the one or two songs they like or, you know, listen out of order. You know, I'm still like that when I hear things where people have changed order to old records that I love, like a Beatles record. And it drives me insane because my DNA knows exactly when that next song's going to be.
What's coming up next?
And if it's not right, it screws the whole process up.
Let me touch on some of the artists and albums that you have worked on in the past. One of my favorite albums from James Taylor is JT from 1977. This felt like something special since it was James's debut on Columbia Records. Was that the feeling in the room at that time? Were you guys like, James really wants to hit the ground running with a new label, or was it just business as usual?
I think there was never a business as usual feel with James, but I think it was just a continuation of the process.
Okay.
Because James was always growing and developing as a writer and as a musician. And, you know, I think that was just representative because there was a whole evolutionary period from JT and then Gorilla and In the Pocket and Flag and all those. To me, they are just some of the greatest albums I've ever worked on. And James is still one of the finest songwriter artists of the generation. So as things went on, I mean, it was a far cry from when we were doing One Man Dog and we were doing it in his half-finished house on Martha's Vineyard.
Sure.
You know, but that was great too. You know, there were moments on working on that record that I could never experience again, like him recording with a chainsaw in the middle of the woods and stuff. So, but JT was really I think it was maybe one of those things where there was a direction going and all of a sudden it shifted. You suddenly just said, okay, now we can go into fifth. Let's go for it.
Who decides that there's going to be a little bass solo on Your Smiling Face?
How much longer? No one can tell me that I'm doing wrong today. Whenever I see you smile at me, no one can tell me that I'm doing wrong today. Whenever I see your smiling face my way, no one can tell me that I'm doing wrong today. No one can tell me that I'm doing wrong today. No, no, darling.
It just happened. You know, the thing that was great with James was when we would be working, he would come in and play guitar and sing a song, and then we would all have to figure out what to do. It was not, here's what I want you guys to play. And it just evolved. It just happened that way. And it turned out to be, to me, it's a simple little segment of the song.
Sure.
But it's become iconic where bass players are always going, oh, God, between, you know, Doctor My Eyes and Your Smiling Face, they say, if you'd only done those two songs, you would have had a career, kind of a thing. And I go, well, that's not enough of a career to pay the bills, but it's a, you know, but I'm real proud of all the things. There's the thing that's great is everybody has on those records their moments to shine, yet nothing distracts from the picture that's being painted. So we all have our little moments where Cooch would throw in a lick here, or Waddy would throw one in, or Russ would do a, where, you know, other drummers would be playing a song with sticks and Russ would come in and play it with brushes and change the whole texture of the song. And it suddenly becomes iconic.
Yeah.
So we each have our own thing. So for me, Smiling Face became one of those. Yet there's, I forget the name of the song, but there's one where the whole intro an outro of it is a bass solo, but it doesn't sound like bass. I think I did it on piccolo bass.
Okay.
And but you always try to leave a little mark in each song, a little signature hook or something in it. But you, at the end of the day, the thing for all of us is our careers were based on a song. We're all songsmiths. So it's not like dig me, check my chops kind of a thing. You listen to the song and sometimes you try to find the least you can do to support the song so that you don't want to be the thing that's being listened to. You want to be the thing that if they don't hear it, something's missing.
Gotcha. So. Good way to think about it. Well, you're talking about singing and as you get older and keeping the voice, but James Taylor is someone who still has the vocal chops.
Yeah.
Still fantastic.
I don't think he ever, even though there's songs that he's done like Steamroller and stuff where he can really dig in and he can can rock hard that a lot of people don't realize until they see him live and they go, holy shit, that guy can really do. But for the most part, he's never forced his voice.
Right.
And he got, you know, there was a period where he was really struggling with his kind of health issues and stuff just because of, you know, problems with addiction and all that. When he finally cleaned up, he got really serious about, he practices vocalizing before shows. You know, he's got tapes that he listens to that he warms up to. So he's not going out there ill prepared.
Yeah.
You know, when he does sing. And, you know, it was, you know, like Ronstadt was that way. I think if Linda still was able to sing.
Yeah.
She would never be changing keys because her instrument was so finely tuned. And so, you know, some people, you know, they've been really hard on their voices. They haven't taken care of themselves. And a lot of it's genetics, too. You know, I mean, it's like you listen to early Joni Mitchell and you listen to Joni now. I mean, she's like two octaves below where she started at, you know, it's a whole, and that's years of smoking and all this stuff.
Right. Sure. All that stuff beats up the voice.
Yeah. Yeah.
Speaking of Linda Ronstadt, 1989, the song is I Need You from Cry Like a Rainstorm, Howl Like the Wind, Linda and Aaron Neville. Some cool bass on that track. Really cool.
Like a ball needs a game. I need you like a pool.
When you're sitting in a studio and you have headphones on and you're listening to Linda and Aaron singing live, man, you got to bring your A game to it. And those songs, they're just beautiful songs. And they really, I've always loved playing ballads. There's a real, you know, I mean, I came into this as a rock musician. When I, in the 60s, I was always in rock bands. When I met James, I had never really played that kind of music before, but it suddenly became, my name became synonymous with like the ballad singers and the soft rock. But there's something about when you're doing ballads like that and you just kind of go, it becomes so expressive. It's really emotional to me. And ballads like those, or, you know, when I would listen to like Foreigner, Journey, you know, with these arena ballads, you know, what these guys did. I love that kind of stuff. I did an album with Mike Reno from Loverboy, and we did a couple of power ballads on that. And I just, every time I hear them, I just go, God, I love that shit.
But now I realize that you've grown so far away. I've lost the girl I knew in yesterday. And now I'm staring out all alone. Maybe we can work it out. Like a
it's so strong, but boy, when you're sitting there listening to Aaron and Linda, I did an album called Butterfly with Streisand, and it was full live orchestra, live vocals, everything. You know, you put your headphones on and you're playing, and you become immersed in something that's really transcendental. And you find yourself, it's almost like an out-of-body experience when you're recording that stuff. When I did work with Streisand and we did Evergreen. When I worked with Diana Ross and we did the theme to Mahogany.
Do you know where you're going to? Do you like the things that life is showing you? Where are you going to? Do you know? Do you get what you're hoping for? When you look behind you, there's no open doors. What are you hoping for? Do you know? Once we were standing still in time, chasing the fantasies that filled our minds. You knew how I loved you, but my spirit was free.
You just kind of close your eyes and you're not there anymore. You're in this other space and you're playing things that if you had to do it again 5 minutes later, you might not be able to do it because it's that moment. And with Linda, it was always that way because her voice was one of the greatest voices of the generation of ever, but certainly of the generation.
When you drive home from the studio after being in the room with an orchestra and Barbara Streisand, are you just on a high for the rest of the night until you go to sleep?
If you get to sleep.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, you know, sometimes like when I would finish sessions like that, I'd get in the car to go home and I would turn on talk radio just to come down from it. Because it's so astounding. And there's times where you're sitting there in the studio and you first off, you can't believe you're in this company.
Yeah.
So you're looking at all these other musicians who are the greatest musicians of in the world in there. And I find this like when I go on the road with Lyle Lovett and the large band, we got 15 guys in the band. And sometimes I'm playing and I can't remember if we've played the bridge yet or not on something because I'm so digging the other guys playing. You know, so you got to kind of keep on top of your game from that standpoint because it's really easy to get lost in this thing that happens when you're in that environment. When we would do big movie dates, big orchestral dates, and you're sitting in this magnificent orchestra and you're just going, holy crap, you know, you really can get lost in it if you're
a musician. In 1976, when you guys were recording the Running on Empty album, I mean, that was an experiment that worked.
Yeah.
So you guys had no idea that was going to be what it turned out to be.
Well, it wasn't supposed to be. Actually, like in the documentary, Russ mentions that he had spoken with Jackson because the original intention was doing like a greatest hits tour and then throwing in a few new tunes. And Russ said to him, why don't we just do all the new songs and not the old songs?
Yeah.
That was, nobody had done that at that point. Nobody went on a giant tour playing all new material for an audience because most audiences want to hear the shit that they want to hear.
Yeah.
So it was a unique experience. And plus we re-recorded everything. I mean, Greg Ladani was engineering it and we recorded in hotel rooms, in the bus, every gig, just going for it. And we would maybe work on a song in the morning, like in a hotel room, and then put it in the show that night. And it was an experiment that I think it required a certain amount of bravery on Jackson's part, because you're really putting something out that nobody's expecting. But he's that kind of an artist.
Yeah.
Where I have so much respect for Jackson as a writer and as a humanitarian, and as just a friend. He's one of the special ones. And I was proud to be a part of that journey on that tour. And plus, the section got to open the shows. So we went out and played our set and did our instrumental rock fusion, and then came right back like 15 minutes later and played the whole Running on Empty show. So
wow, what a night that would be for you guys playing.
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Yeah, Shaky Town, written by Danny Korchmar, recorded in room 124, Holiday Inn, Edwardsville, Illinois.
Yep.
I wonder if that Holiday Inn's still there, and I wonder how many people want to stay in room 124.
Seen folks show their blacker sides. Seen them die just for foolish pride. And those drivers always ask to hear that same old song.
You know, I don't know if it's there or not. That one of the other places we work at was a Holodome in Merrillville, Indiana, and that's gone now. I know that one's gone, but I don't, you know, I mean, they might, you know, there might be those kind of things. It's like going to Père Lachaise and wanting to go see Jim Morrison's grave. You know, I mean, some of these things do, for certain people, they do become this kind of bucket list journey that they're on. So there might be people that would go there and say, I want to stay in that room. But it won't look quite the same. The bed will be actually put together and not taken apart to make a drum booth and all that stuff. It's insane. It was nuts. It was really a crazy tour.
1997, Lisa Loeb's Firecracker album. You play bass on the song I Do.
When I'm done with thinking, then I'm done with you. When I'm done with crying, and then I'm done with you. When I feel so tired, and then I'm done with you. You know, everybody feels this way sometimes. Everybody feels this way. And
I was talking with Lisa one day and talking about bass players, and your name came up, and I had attributed you to someone else. Like, that's, oh yeah, James Taylor's bass, whatever I said. And Lisa said, no, 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 he's my bass player.
So. I love Lisa. You know, and again, that's another one of those people that time has is elusive, because you see her and she's look exactly the same, like Susanna. It's like, yep. I just noticed that we're going to be doing some gigs with Lisa with Lyle later this year.
Oh, excellent.
Now, we're still really close friends, and I just think she's just the best. She's
so nice.
She's great.
Now, in this career, Leland, you've worked with so many people. Do you have a bucket list? Is there someone you haven't worked with yet that you would still love to get in the room with?
Oh, lots of them. I mean, I've always been a massive Steve Winwood fan. I still think Back in the Highlight is one of the greatest records ever recorded. I still listen to that on a regular basis, and I've never had the chance to work with him. Kind of indirectly, I did a little bit, something that Elton was involved in, but I would love to have been able to be with Elton. I remember going to shows of his, and you just song after song after song, you're going, holy crap.
Yeah.
Every time I get together with Billy Gibbons, we joke about playing together. You know, there's a lot of people, because I'm at the end of the day, I'm still fanboy. Mm-hmm. You know, so there's a lot of artists out there that I would have loved to have had a chance to play with. I would love to have had a chance to play with Stevie Wonder. You know, I've played with him in weird circumstances, like a fundraiser, and like we're doing the house band, and he'll come out and he'll play. But to actually really do, you know, a legit album or tour. But I also just, at the end of the day, I go, being fanboy too, I can sit and listen to all the records of all these people and enjoy them. It's weird, you know. It's like, I remember when Jaco Pastorius hit the scene, and every bass player in town was running home trying to shed to play like Jaco. And I'm going, can't you just dig a genius? And he's already done it. So, you know, why are you compelled to? And nobody's going to do it like him, because he's the signature. He's the benchmark. But you know, when I get to walk in a studio and do an album with Andy Griffith, you know, I just went, I'm sitting there pinching myself, you know, and people would go, Andy Griffith? And I go, I had the best time in the studio with Andy and friends, and he was calling me saying, you know, how you doing? What you up to? And I'm sitting there freaking out going, why? It's Andy Griffith.
That's amazing.
Yeah. I mean, there's all of that kind of stuff, or other projects that I've done that people are totally unaware of, like things like Helen Reddy's I Am Woman, or the Weather Girls, It's Raining Men, all that kind of stuff.
I am woman, hear me roar, in numbers too big to ignore, and I know too much to go back and pretend, 'cause I've heard it all before, and I've been down there on the floor. No one's ever gonna keep me down again. Whoa, yes, I'm wise, but it's wisdom for the pain. Yes, I paid the price, but look how much I gained. If I have to, I can do anything. I am strong.
You know, the thing I feel most fortunate in my career is diversity, that I've been able to do projects in every genre and with artists that, you know, from all over the world, from Japan to New Zealand to Germany to Norway to Africa. I feel really fortunate that I've had the diversity, and I think that's one of the things that's kept it all feeling really fresh for me.
And then after all these years, the phone still rings.
Yeah, I mean, knock on wood, you know. It's just, I still pinch myself every day that I'm still at it. And not so much that I don't think I can do it, but, you know, there's an element of this feeling like a flavor of the month industry.
Yeah.
And when you suddenly, you know, you find yourself doing projects and you're still working with, you know, people in their 20s.
Yeah.
And you could be almost their great grandfather at that point. Yet the minute that red light comes on in the studio, we're all in the zone together. And I'm appreciative of that all the time and never take it for granted.
That's good. I think that's probably why you've lasted so long in the industry too, to have an outlook like that, plus the chops.
Yeah. It all adds up, you know, I mean, and you just try to be somebody that people want to hang with in there, because that can be the kiss of death for a lot of players, is they're a drag to be around. So no matter how good they are, people go, I don't want to work with him.
You know? Right. Exactly. Yeah. One of the people I want to talk about before I let you go today is a woman that we lost a little while back, Lisa Roy.
Yeah.
I only had an email relationship with Lisa until you guys were coming to Bogies in Westlake Village.
Yeah.
And then Lisa invited me to come to the show. And that's the first night I met her. And again, I had only had an email relationship with her. And she treated me like I was a journalist from Time Magazine. I mean, made sure I was comfortable, made sure I had a good seat, kept checking on me. I mean, all these things that I was not expecting. She was just so delightful. And then she made sure that she brought me to you guys so that I could meet you in person. And at one point, security was stopping me and she said, no, he's with me. And just delightful. And when she passed, I even felt sad at just that one meeting.
Yeah. She was one of the most remarkable people I've ever known in this business. Sure, when you would meet her at first, you'd kind of go like this, because she was such a presence. She was a package. I first became friends with her. She was married to a producer engineer named, I forget how his last name, Chubba. He was Czech, C-S-A-B-A was his first name, okay. Chubba. And they were great together. And then he developed cancer and she saw him through all of that. But she was one of the most dynamic energy people in this business. And when she and Danny became a couple, it was the happiest I've ever seen Danny in his life. I mean, they were like this perfect pair. And when she passed, we were all in absolute shock that this happened. But the band probably wouldn't have happened without her.
Yeah,
certainly the documentary wouldn't have happened without her, because she was a driving force behind it. And one of the things I'm most grateful of is before she passed away, she saw a rough cut of the movie.
Oh, good.
So there was that little bit of, not closure, but you know, that she got to see some of the fruits of her labors really come to fruition. But I miss her all the time. I mean, but she was one of those people you'd walk in a room and she didn't look like anybody else in the room. She was quite a package. And I would see her back. I saw her down in Nashville quite a few times. And she would come walking through the airport and all these guys in like their cowboy hats and boots would walk. They looked like they had slinky eyes in there. she would definitely could stop traffic going through the airport. And, but she was brilliant, number one, but caring. Like my wife was talking about it the other day. She goes, I could never believe, like when we'd come to a gig, she'd always double check our and triple check our seats, make sure we got what we needed and stuff. She was so thoughtful and knew all the right things to make things right. It wasn't just getting in your face trying to take care of stuff. I mean, she knew exactly what would make for a good evening and not waste time. And, I miss her every day. It's really been a massive loss to our immediate family, because she was definitely in it. And I'm really glad there's a acknowledgement of her at the end of the movie.
Yes, for sure. And we say it here in all reverence. We say, rock in peace, Lisa Roy.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, Leland, in closing, this might be a difficult question, might be an easy question. Let me tell where people can find you on everything. Website, LelandSklarsBeard.com and ImmediateFamilyBand.com. Mm-hmm. On Twitter, at Ahmed Family, immediate, it's T-H-E-I-M-M-E-D Family. Instagram, Leland.Sklar, and Instagram, it's the same as the Twitter, The Ahmed Family. Album is out right now, Skin in the Game. Go get it. Vinyl, CD, digital download.
And come sign up and join my YouTube channel.
Yes, please do. Very entertaining, insightful, funny. You'll love it. You'll learn stuff. And you do such natural videos. I'm seeing you here right now. This is how you look when you do the videos. It's in that room.
Yeah.
And I really feel like I've entered your home. You want to hear this, watch those videos.
I already called security. They're on their way here now.
All right. Final question, Leland. I need you to choose a playout song for the episode. It can be any song from your career. It can certainly be a song from the new Immediate Family album called Skin in the Game.
Well, why don't we just play Skin in the Game?
All right. Title track.
That's where we're all at this point. If you don't have skin in the game, you can't complain about anything. You got to commit.
Exactly. And people, vote come November. Vote.
Absolutely. Vote. Please, please, please. Our world depends on it.
All right, Leland, a pleasure to chat with you. Thanks for giving me your time. Listeners, please enjoy Skin in the Game. Thank you, Leland.
Thanks for having me. And if you need me again, I'm here for you.
Oh, I would love it. Thank you. Take care.
Great. Take care. Bye-bye.
Find cars like these on Auto Trader, like that car riding your tail. Or if you're tailgating right now, all those cars doubling as kitchens and living rooms are on Auto Trader too. Are you working out and listening to this ad at the same time? Well, multitasking pro, cars like the ones in the gym parking lot are for sale on Auto Trader. New cars, used cars, electric cars, maybe even flying cars. Okay, no flying cars, but as soon as they get invented, they'll be on Auto Trader. Just you wait. Auto Trader.